now. There's a lot of misinformation out there about autism, from myths about vaccines to misconceptions about who's affected by autism. Our next guest is a reporter who's on the autism spectrum himself. In his new book, he shares stories from people around the country and tackles some of those myths and misconceptions. And he says, we need to rethink the autism conversation and move from talking about cures and treatments to finding better ways to include people at work, at school, and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you autistic? Or is someone in your family, one of your loved ones, autistic? What do you think people get wrong about it? What are ways that society is not built for people with autism? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Eric Michael Garcia is a senior D.C. correspondent for The Independent. He's the author of the new book, We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you talk a little bit about what led you as a reporter, a journalist with autism, to tackle this book and talk to people around the country to share their stories?
Sure. So first off, I was born. I was born autistic. That's an old joke for you. The second thing that happened was that I moved to Washington, D.C. when I was 23. I moved to be an economics and politics journalist. I always wanted to be that. Didn't think I'd ever be anything more than that. Then I was at a party one night with a friend by the name of Tim Mack. And he offered me a drink. And I said, oh, I don't drink because I'm on the autism spectrum. And I don't. And a medicine I take doesn't mix with alcohol. And he's like, oh, there's a lot of autistic people in Washington, D.C. in politics, in law, in journalism, and things like that. He's like, you should write something about that. And I thought, okay, you know, maybe one day. But then when I was at National Journal and then they were shutting down the print magazine, I pitched that article to my editor. And he's like, well, why should this exist? And he's like, well, I said, well, I think we focus too much on trying to cure autistic people, not enough on trying to help them live fulfilling lives. He's like, there's your piece right there. And then, so I wrote that piece. That broke big. And then my next question was, well, what would that look like? And you have to remember, around this time in 2015, I grew up in Southern California. There was a big measles outbreak at Disneyland, if you remember. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, those are a bunch of hippies in California. And at the same time, Donald Trump was running for president, and he was saying that autism has become an epidemic. He blamed vaccines, just saying a lot of things that were just not true. So my feeling was, somewhere along the line, we've gotten a lot wrong about autism. And as a political journalist, my feeling is, okay, if we're getting things wrong about autism, that must mean that what we do to help, quote unquote, help autistic people must be really bad too. So I hit the road, and I'm a political journalist at heart. So I decided to hit the road and see, how are we failing autistic people? But more importantly, what could be done to make things better for autistic people?
And a recurring theme in your book, I mean, it's in the title, you just mentioned it, it's all throughout the book, this idea that we're not broken, you're not broken, and moving the conversation from how do we prevent autism, cure autism, fix autism, whatever, to how do we change society so that we include people with different neurodiversity, I think is the phrase often used.
Different neurodivergent, you know. So the stat I always give is that of the $364 million the United States spends, both with nonprofits and with the federal government, spends on autism research, and this is from 2016, only about 2% of that goes toward lifespan issues. By comparison, about 35% of autism spending research goes on biology, and about 24% goes on risk factors. So that's about half of our research budget goes to what causes autism, and then, you know, what are risk factors. And then on top of that, there are treatments. So that's a large part of it. And then we're not really spending that much on what happens to autistic people as they grow up. What are the difficulties that they face? What are the difficulties as they want to go to school, or if they can't go to school, or if they can work, or if they can't work? What's the problems facing unemployment? So to me, that seemed like a big problem, because it seemed like for a long time we were focusing on what parents or what researchers or what clinicians or professors wanted, and less on what can we actually do for the people right here and right now. You know, even if you were to create a cure, that's not going to help autistic people who you have right now.
One other misconception you look at is who people think of as autistic. And I think the image that I'll admit usually would pop into my mind, and I think for a lot of people, is they're young, they're white, and they're male. And that is not accurate at all, right?
Right. I mean, like the classic example is if you look at shows like The Good Doctor or what's the other one? Atypical, or even going back to shows like or movies like Rain Man, the archetype of an autistic person is typically a young, typically adolescent or teenage white male, sometimes older. And if you look at covers like Time and Newsweek, I went back and I looked at a lot of covers of Time magazine, and it was like young, you know, blonde haired adolescent boys. But like, A, that excludes a lot of adults. B, that excludes a lot of women and girls, and C, that really excludes a lot of people of color. And it goes back to my point that in the original study about autism in 1943, the first widely read study about autism in 1943, Autistic Disturbances of Affective Contact by Leo Kanner, none of the children were people of color. Only 3 of them were girls. 9 of them were from Anglo-Saxon families, and the other 2 were Jewish. And as a result, we kind of still have that idea of those are the type of people who can be autistic.
We're talking to Eric Michael Garcia about his new book, We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. You can join in with your thoughts, your experiences, maybe your questions at 800-642-1234. A quote, Eric, that struck me in your book is from John Elder Robison, an autistic author and advocate. I'm quoting him now, as you quoted in your book. Our duty in autism is not to cure, but to relieve suffering and to maximize each person's potential. Can you talk about that mindset as a starting point?
Certainly. I think that a lot of people say that we talk about not curing autism. We're saying that autism is all rainbows and butterflies, or it's not a disability. Autism is a disability. I will say that from the rooftops. But what we should do is we should work to fix the impairments, or work to help autistic people with their impairments. And then we should also work to maximize their potential. And just like how deaf people don't want to be cured, or blind people don't want to be cured, we wouldn't want to cure people with Down syndrome. We should work to improve the lives of autistic people, get rid of the impairments, but then also find ways to make the world more adaptable to them, and find ways to make the world better for them. So a statistic that I cite, and we don't even really know, is that autistic people, around 85% of autistic young adults we know, deal with unemployment. That's a big social problem. We should look at what does it take to help autistic people find work and make sure that they have good jobs if they want to work, or if they can work. What does it take, and how can we facilitate that more than just, oh, we should try to fix them, you know?
You give an example from your own career, your academic career at community college, then at the University of North Carolina, about accommodations for you that you were initially reluctant to ask about.
So, I mean, I think that a lot of autistic people and a lot of disabled people as a whole, especially when you go to university, you've already gone through a special education system at one point or another, and you've seen how often it usually doesn't help, or it's segregating and it's isolating, or you get treated, or you know, because kids can be so cruel, they see that it puts a mark on your back, or there's a lot of other things. So a lot of times we just don't want to talk about it. And then also we're afraid that we're going to be seen as getting special treatment. It's why I'm not a fan of the term special needs. But those accommodations are there, and they're there for a reason, and they matter. And I think that a lot of times we have to overcome our ableism, our internalized ableism, and the thoughts that, you know, we're told from the beginning of our lives that we're a problem. And we need to recognize that those services are there for a reason. And I think on top of that, we're also kind of told that, well, if you're at university, you must not be really disabled, right? Which is like such a terrible thing to say, because it says that only certain types of people can go to university. It says that you can't go to university if you're disabled. What we should do is we should say that, you know, you're here for a reason. These accommodations are here to help you, are here to help you. And we should not fear them, you know?
We continue our talk with Eric Michael Garcia about his new book, We're Not Broken, Changing the Autism Conversation. You can join in 800-642-1234 with your experiences, maybe with autism yourself or with a loved one, or your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Eric, as part of your work on this book, you talked to people who need more care in their everyday lives, who, for example,
yes,
maybe university may not be an option, who had experiences different than your own. What kind of things did you learn from them?
Yeah, they were, it was really important for me to include autistic people who have higher support needs or maybe who can't speak. And it was important for me to say that because or maybe university might not be an option for them. And it was important for me because I wanted to show that they could have a good life and that it's possible to have a good life. Because I think a lot of times people say, and I knew the response to this book would be, oh, it's easy for you to say because you are quote unquote high functioning, even though I'm not a fan of that term. And you are successful, you have a job, things like that. But what about my kid? So I wanted to include people who are, A, I believe that I have a lot more in common with your kid than you realized. B, I wanted to include people like these kids, and like your child. And I wanted to show that it was possible to live a good and happy life. And the way we do that is by having, A support system around you, a support system around these people, and B, that we... that it requires spending and it requires prioritization of these things. And it requires that we prioritize ensuring that these people have home and community-based services that they so that they can live in the community, that these are actual home and community-based services, that they're not just de facto institutions like they often have been. Or we wanted to, you know, I wanted to show that it's possible for them to, that they should have, you know, home care workers who care about them and take them seriously and take their medical needs seriously. I wanted to make sure that if they have intellectual disabilities, they aren't exploited in different workshops, segregated workshops, or paid below the minimum wage, which is completely legal and people don't realize that. So it was really important for me to include their voices as well.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kathy is with us in Winona, Minnesota. Kathy, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking this call. My question is regarding, first of all, Eric, you're a brilliant guy, and kudos to you for doing what you do.
Thank you.
I have met a young man who's 24 years old. He's very affected by autism. He is not able to live by himself. He goes to a day program, but... he says to me, I am not autistic, I have autism. And I'm wondering, I hear you referring to autistic people, and I'm wondering which you prefer.
Kathy, thanks for the call.
So,
yeah, go ahead, Eric.
That is a good question. That is a really good question. The thing that I did when I was traveling around, I made sure to ask, was I was really keen to ask people, do you prefer to use what's called person first language or identity first language? Person first language is, I believe, what this gentleman is referring to himself as. I have autism, and then I tend to say that I'm autistic. And A, it's everybody's personal preference, and I'm not going to tell anybody how to refer to themselves. But B, I think the change comes because for a long time, parents of autistic people wanted to make sure that their children weren't defined by their disability, or they were afraid that if they were called autistic, that it would lead to stigma. I think a younger generation, even though this young man, I think, is younger than I am, he's 24 and I'm 30 years old, a lot of younger autistic people, and I guess people who have understood themselves more, see that autism is inextricable from who they are. That a lot of people say, see the person, not the disability, or don't let your disability define you. No, like, I really need need you to see my disability, and I need you to see other autistic people's disability, and I need you to see that A, that doesn't make them less, but B, that it is an intrinsic part to who they are. So I think that there's a divide, but again, I think that it really depends on how that person sees themselves. And again, I wouldn't tell this young man how to, I'm feeling old now, but I wouldn't tell this young man how to see himself. But I would, but more than anything, I'm curious why he sees that as important. Why that distinction is important? Because it's a distinction we all take and we all carry with each other. So,
thanks a lot for the call and the question, Kathy, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Eric Michael Garcia. His new book is "We're Not Broken: Changing the Autism Conversation." Let's go back to your calls now. Michelle is with us in Kenosha. Michelle, hi.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi. Love this conversation. I have an uncle who was born in 1935 and wasn't diagnosed with autism till about 10 years ago. What I find interesting is, you know, that's just who he was. So our family had to deal with that. But he did have a successful life as a cabinet refinisher. He's extremely good with wood. But one thing I picked up on that you were talking about is how to deal with how to address needs as people get older, because now that he's in his 80s, it's been a challenge because he feels pain differently. And so my cousins and I have to work with the medical professionals so that they understand, like, if he starts doing this grunting or screaming, he's in pain, but he doesn't know how to communicate that. So, you know, it has been important for us to be translators for him. And it's interesting because, you know, on his own, it's like nobody listens. But if we help translate, then all of a sudden the doctor's like, oh, that's right. And then he gets treated and it solves the problem.
Michelle, thanks for that call. Eric, go for it.
That is really good. First off, that reminds me a lot of this woman and her mother I profiled in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, by the name of Lil Wayman, and her mother, Brookie. That, like, a lot of people didn't take Lydia seriously, but they took her mom seriously, so that when they go to the hospital, like, her mom goes with her. And that was really important because, like, she recognized that, like, and in some ways she could be an advocate for her. And then now Lydia can speak. So, you know, it's not, you know, she's not taken as unseriously as other people, even though there, I have some stories about, like, how people didn't think that she thought she was faking. But, like, that's really good that you recognize that him grunting or his screaming or things like that are him trying to communicate something. Because I think a lot of times when we focus on is that when people see that see autistic people screaming or see them, you know, grunting or even hurting themselves, a lot of times we focus on the behavior, but we don't focus on what actually is causing it. So A, that's really good. But B, you know, to my point, that's really why I wanted to write this book, because we really don't know a lot of things. I can't really, as much as I would like to give you a good answer, I don't think I could give you a good one, because we haven't, again, we only spend about 2%. In 2016, we only spent about 2% of all of our entire research budget looking at lifespan issues. And that's really tragic, because autism, and I think about it too, because eventually I'm going to get old. I'm going to be like, you know, your uncle. And I don't know what's going to happen. And that's a really tough question. I don't really know. I wish I had a better answer, but I don't. I'm sorry.
Thanks for that call. And Eric, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Eric Michael Garcia. He's a senior DC correspondent for The Independent, longtime political correspondent. He joined us for a look at his book today. It's called We're Not Broken: Changing the Autism Conversation. If you have a story to share with us, there's still time. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or you can always tweet us @CentralTimeWPR.